Redeem Air. Tweet at LBC.
Every Friday at 4:45, Simon Marks's American Week.
Eddie, it's been an emotional American week on a number of different fronts, but none more so than in Minneapolis. The trial of Derek Chauvin, the former police officer denying charges that he murdered George Floyd last May, sparking national, indeed global, protests, has gripped the country. The testimony from prosecution witnesses has often been as searing as the 9.5-minute video shown to the jury at the very start of proceedings on Monday.
My stomach hurts. My neck hurts. Everything hurts. There's water or something. Please. Please. I can't breathe all the time.
The more you see of that video, the harder it is to watch. Derek Chauvin keeps his knee compressed against George Floyd's neck long after Mr. Floyd has passed out, and to the utter fury of onlookers.
Bro, you gonna just sit there with your knee on his neck, bro? You a real man for that, bro. He ain't handcuffed, bro.
Just
a real man, bro.
We have heard this week from every single one of them, men and women who stumbled upon the scene and urged Derek Chauvin and his fellow officers to show some semblance of humanity as it became apparent Mr. Floyd's life was ebbing away. From Donald Williams, a martial arts fighter who testified that he recognized a chokehold when he saw one and became so alarmed that he called 911, alerting the police to the actions of the police.
That is correct. I did call the police.
Right. And why did you do that?
Because I believe I witnessed a murder.
Genevieve Hansen was the off-duty emergency medical technician with the Minneapolis Fire Department who also stumbled across the scene and could be heard on the tape urging the police to let her check Mr. Floyd's vital signs and try to resuscitate him. The police wouldn't let her.
Why weren't you able to do any of that?
Because the officers didn't let me in to the scene. I also offered, in my memory, I offered to walk them through it or told them, if he doesn't have a pulse, you need to start compressions. And that wasn't done either. It's what I would have done for anybody.
And when you couldn't do that, how did that make you feel?
Totally distressed.
Were you frustrated?
Yes.
Like so many witnesses this week, she wept on the stand. And perhaps the most startling aspect of the testimony we've heard, many of those onlookers to George Floyd's death expressed more remorse for their actions that day than the country has yet heard conveyed from Derek Chauvin.
When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad. I look at my brothers. I look at my cousins, my uncles, because they are all black. And I look at that and I look at how that could have been one of them.
Darnella Frazier is the 18-year-old who filmed the cell phone video that went viral around the world.
It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more and not physically interacting and not saving his life, but it's like, it's not what I should have done. It's what he should have done.
She gestured at Derek Chauvin in the courtroom. Perhaps no witness is more tortured by events than Christopher Martin, the 19-year-old supermarket cashier who sold George Floyd a packet of cigarettes, sparking the entire incident. He told the court Mr. Floyd was clearly drugged to the gills when he walked into the shop and paid with a counterfeit $20 bill. His manager told Mr. Martin to go and bring Mr. Floyd back into the shop. After a first attempt failed, Mr. Martin offered to replace the fake banknote with one of his own. The manager said no and again demanded that the cashier go and confront Mr. Floyd. Eventually, police were called, and within minutes, Derek Chauvin had his knee on George Floyd's neck while the supermarket cashier joined those on the pavement watching.
We saw you standing there with your hands on your head for a while, correct? Correct. What was going through your mind during that time period?
Disbelief and guilt.
Okay. Why guilt?
If I would have just not taken the bill, this could have been avoided.
Minneapolis is on edge today. Security has been tightened. The city's police chief is expected to testify in the case. He says Derek Chauvin used excessive force in his treatment of George Floyd, presenting the defense with yet more complexities as the trial proceeds. But Mr. Chauvin's lawyers have made it clear they will argue it was George Floyd's opioid addiction that caused his death, that the police felt they were at risk of attack from the bystanders and were scared that Mr. Floyd, under the influence of fentanyl, could regain consciousness and become violent. They only need to persuade one juror, and that task began yesterday when Courtney Ross, George Floyd's girlfriend, took to the stand and conceded that 2 months before his death, he took an unintentional overdose.
Just wasn't feeling well, and he said he had to go to the hospital, so I took him straight to the hospital.
You later learned that that was due to an overdose?
Yes.
Overruled.
At that time frame, did you learn that Mr. Floyd was taking anything other than opioids?
No.
Okay. You did not know that he had taken heroin at that time?
No.
Character assassination, Mr. Floyd's family calls it, but with even police chiefs turning on Derek Chauvin, his lawyers are left with little else. The trial's outcome will be a potentially incendiary moment in America, but that's not expected for perhaps 3 more weeks. By then, it seems certain the United States will be in the grips of a fourth wave, depending on how you count these things, of COVID-19. The country that has, for the last 13 months, proved entirely unable to help itself is once again exhibiting a familiar pattern. Exactly 3 weeks ago, President Biden told Americans the end was in sight. By July the 4th, they would be celebrating Independence Day with burgers and beers in their backyards. This week, backpedaling. It started with an emotional plea from Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the head of the Centers for Disease Control.
I'm going to pause here. I'm going to lose the script, and I'm going to reflect on the recurring feeling I have of impending doom. We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason for hope. But right now, I'm scared.
Now, it seems to me if she's scared, the country probably should be as well. While you listen to this next bit, I'm just going to go and put the burgers back in the freezer.
So I'm speaking today not necessarily as your CDC director, or not only as your CDC director, but as a wife, as a mother, as a daughter, to ask you to just please hold on a little while longer. I so badly want to be done. I know you all so badly want to be done. We are just almost there, but not quite yet.
I don't know who she thinks she's speaking to, because she's urging people there to just hang on as though there's been some united patriotic effort from coast to coast to head off the virus. But there hasn't been. Instead, we've seen non-stop arguments about the efficacy of face masks and social distancing, pandemic denialists breaking into hospitals with video cameras in a bid to prove that they are not, in fact, overrun with COVID-19. And this week alone, millions of Americans on the move again, in total disregard again of CDC guidelines. For the second year running, the spring break holiday is serving as a super spreader event. And the second president, never to tell people to call off their beach plans, is now angry with them for hitting the road.
Because we're in the life and death race for the virus that is spreading quickly, with cases rising again, new variants are spreading. And sadly, some of the reckless behavior we've seen on television over the past few weeks means that more new cases are to come in the weeks ahead. With vaccines, there's hope. But people are letting up on precautions, which is a very bad thing.
So let's talk about vaccines. Here in the world's most advanced economy, we learnt this week that 15 million doses of the Johnson & Johnson jab are being chucked away after a manufacturing plant in Baltimore made a mistake. They mixed the ingredients for the J&J jab with the ingredients for the Oxford AstraZeneca jab. It's a bit like me confusing Nigella's recipe for aubergine curry with Ottolenghi's. Too much garam masala and you have to throw the whole thing out. It's almost enough to make you wonder whether this country couldn't use a bit of an infrastructure overhaul.
It's not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America. Unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the interstate highway system and the space race decades ago.
President Biden this week unveiling his very ambitious $2 trillion plan to fix the roads, repair the bridges, remove the old lead water pipes, build a national broadband network, and more broadly, compete with China.
We'll create millions of jobs, good-paying jobs. We'll grow the economy. It's big, yes. It's bold, yes. And we can get it done.
But can he? To pay for it, he's planning to raise corporation tax from 21 to 28%. And Republicans say that will be a job killer. Mitch McConnell, their leader in the Senate.
As much as we would like to address infrastructure, is not going to get support from our side, because I think the last thing the economy needs right now is a big whopping tax increase.
So once again, the president will need to keep every single Democrat in the Senate on side if he's to get his plan through. It will be an all-consuming task for the White House in the coming weeks. To the mirth of Democrats, Republicans are currently more than a touch distracted. This was the week when, for Congressman Matt Gaetz of Florida, one of Donald Trump's top supporters in the House of Representatives, the walls started caving in.
The person doesn't exist. I have not had a relationship with a 17-year-old. That is totally false. The allegation, as I read it in the New York Times, is that I've traveled with some 17-year-old in some relationship. That is false, and records will bear that out to be false.
His denial on Fox News on Wednesday night was sparked by reports that the Department of Justice is investigating him in a sex trafficking probe. Events have advanced rapidly since then. The man who once wore a gas mask in Congress to lampoon the notion that the pandemic was a threat to America is now awash in lurid allegations that threaten to engulf other Republicans in the House of Representatives. One man determined not to be touched by them, Tucker Carlson of Fox News, who gave Matt Gaetz a platform to explain himself this week without realizing that the congressman was about to drag the TV host into the scandal.
I can say that actually you and I went to dinner about 2 years ago. Your wife was there and I brought a friend of mine. You'll remember her. And she was actually threatened by the FBI, told that if she wouldn't cop to the fact that somehow I was involved in some pay-for-play scheme, that she could face trouble. And so I do believe that there are people at the Department of Justice who are trying to smear me.
I don't remember the woman you're speaking of or the context at all, honestly.
And with that, the interview came to a crashing conclusion. Matt Gaetz is one of the modern-day crackpots of American politics, but there was a reminder this week that over the years, this city has been no stranger to radical oddballs. On Tuesday night, G. Gordon Liddy died at the age of 90. He was the mastermind of the Watergate burglary, the break-in at the Democratic Party's headquarters in 1972 that ultimately led to the collapse of Richard Nixon's presidency. He was in the building communicating with the burglars that he'd hired over a two-way radio.
We got a whispered from them, they got us. And then, of course, the lights all went on and, you know, police cars and everything like that. And we knew that they had been apprehended, so Hunt and I took as much of the gear as we could, walked out, walked past the police, got in our cars and left. I went home. My wife woke up when I went into the bedroom, and I said something like, things didn't go well today. I think I'm going to have to go to jail.
He did go to jail for 4.5 years and then became the darling of the right on talk radio.
This is the G-Man. We are go for launch.
And it is I, G. Gordon. And in the studio visiting me now is a very old dear friend.
For 20 years, you could listen to him for 4 hours an afternoon, telling listeners, among other things, to use photographs of Bill and Hillary Clinton for gun practice and advising them that if they were ever raided by federal agents, they should shoot for the head. F. Scott Fitzgerald once famously claimed there are no second acts in American lives. To that, Eddie, the G-Man would have poured himself a scotch and smiled.
Simon Marks's American Week back next Friday at 4:45. Now, the Steve Allen soundbite of the night.
Let's have a break, shall we?
This is LBC. I'm Eddie Mayer.
Thanks for listening to Simon Marks Reporting. And if you like what you heard, click the subscribe button and come back soon for more. And I'd love it if you'd give me a review. Those can be hugely helpful in spreading the word. Thanks a lot. More from me soon.